coming up in this episode.
If I were a boer, if I were a farmer, and I saw on my news station a rally of tens of thousands of people screaming, kill the farmer, kill the boer, I would have legitimate reason for concern.
I get so frustrated when people are not willing to see the truth because it doesn't fit their ideology or their narrative. And that applies to the left, to the right, to human beings.
The blowback is insane because while it's very political for the families involved, it's completely personal. Having someone call them cowards.
When you run away, you're a coward.
And use that kind of language is not helpful. I never, ever had one moment of hatred to that young man who murdered my son. And part of that came out of my own experience of having been a kid who committed a robbery and went to prison.
You go into prison and the label is, these are convicts, these are criminals, these are animals. The first man I hugged, he wouldn't let go. And I was hugging this man, and it was all I could do to stop weeping, you know. And he was just crying out for love. And I saw in these men a goodness, you know. And I went around one by one and I hugged all 20. And I mean, the brotherhood and the love that flowed. Khalil, man, I mean, USA and South Africa, the relationship is on the map. We're in the news. More than it has been, I mean, I think since Mandela was released, I mean, then in the elections. Now, man, the spotlight's on. I mean, that engagement with Ramaphosa, our president, and Donald Trump, yours, was something to behold. You know, I mean, just to set the tone, I've been blown away at the narratives that have come out of that. It seems as though, you know, you get the accident scene. It can have two witnesses or three, and you get totally different stories. And it seems like the story is driven by the narrative and the ideology in the person's head that's watching the thing. They say what they want to say. I mean, what's your take on this? It's nuts, isn't it?
Well, it's absolutely insane. And I think that part of the challenge for people to look at that and try to understand what's going on is that there are so many conflicting narratives about what should have been done, what people want to see happen. The backdrop is this whole idea that 59 South Africans have migrated to the United States. And for me, the blowback that's coming with this is insane because while it's very political, for the families involved, it's completely personal. It's completely based on how they perceive their circumstances.
Right.
And I just have to tell you, having someone call them cowards and use that kind of language is not helpful. I don't see that being helpful at all. And especially if you're someone who's rich, comfortable, and have a lifestyle that most South Africans can't even hope for at this stage, looking at the economy. So I don't think that there was any benefit in Cyril Ramaphosa, President Ramaphosa, calling the people who decided to migrate to America cowards. I see no benefit in that.
No. And well, I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa is worth over 6 billion rand. 6 billion rand. I mean, he's surrounded by security. So there's no security issues. There's no money issues, But isn't that politicians? You know, they're so separated from the reality of the masses, aren't they? It's so easy to sit in that ivory tower and just pontificate, but they have no idea. But I mean, you're right. The number of narratives coming out of this, and all of them, very few of them, are actually concerned with the truth. We talk about genocide. And, to be honest with you, I think that's the wrong narrative. I don't think there is a genocide happening. But there's a major problem of crime and murders. And what journalists do is they nitpick about, slight technical things that were not exactly, but they miss the point that the crosses that represented on that thing, even though they were representations, may not have been the burial site, but they represented people who were buried and dead. Who cares about the technicalities? The reality is people are dead. You know, why don't we jump into the
serious problem,
the essence, the truth? And I mean, Khalil, I get so frustrated when people are not willing to see the truth because it doesn't fit their ideology or their narrative. And that applies to the left, to the right, to human beings.
Yes. I think that you're raising the most important point about this entire discussion and the anger that I've seen expressed about this very issue. People, for example, organizations in the United States saying that they will not serve the South Africans, they will, because they don't actually fit into the criteria of refugees. And again, it's being politicized all the way across the board. It's being politicized. Now, the issue of genocide being the pretext and people taking exception with that, I'm prepared to have that conversation. We can have that debate as to whether or not there is a sufficient violence to warrant the label of genocide. And I agree with you. Having lived in South Africa, I didn't see the violence in that way. However, if I were a Boer, if I were a farmer, and I saw on my television news station during the day or evening a rally of tens of thousands of people screaming, kill the farmer, kill the Boer, I would have legitimate reason for concern, and I can understand that. So there's a need to kind of take a step back, reflect on how someone might arrive at that kind of thinking and those feelings in their own struggle, in their own story.
Yeah.
And then ask yourself, is it realistic? Can you imagine that you too would feel threatened? You too would feel afraid? You too would feel desperate in a situation like that? And I know, having seeing this happen again and again, people are concerned for their lives. That's not that's not make believe. That's not making something up to make a
it's
point.
It's not theory.
It's not a theory. And until we address that concern, until we are willing to open our eyes up and see that there's something terribly wrong happening, and we're not going down the path that's going to make everybody well, healed, and all those wonderful things that we say we want for our society.
Well, you know, I mean, I love someone said that, you know, facts don't care about your feelings. And I mean, and facts don't care about your ideology either. You know, I mean, and science is science. Yeah. Real is real. You know, false is. And the problem with these discussions is we lose the facts. So if you really look at the facts that should have been brought out in that meeting between Ramaphosa and Trump, the fact is that under this ANC government, the gap between the rich and the poor is greater than it's ever been. The fact is that there are more homeless people than they've ever been. The fact is that our state-owned enterprises, which were amongst the best in the world 20, 30 years ago, are now in a parlous state. The fact is that unemployment rate is of the worst in the world, you know. That the fact is that last year alone in South Africa, 27,000 people were murdered. Yeah, I mean, in 9/11, what was the fatality there? 3,000 or 3.5?
Yeah.
So, I mean, every year South Africa has 8 or 9 9/11s. Now, this is not what these are the facts.
Yeah.
Now, whether you left wing, right wing, conservative, liberal, it doesn't matter. These facts are horrific, and they need to be dealt with. And so we get so caught up in pushing our ideology and our political views that we miss the real facts that need to be dealt with. And I mean, to your point, Khalil, and I think liberals are very guilty of this. They claim to be compassionate, loving, caring people, and yet they say, because you're not a refugee, I don't care about you. You know, I mean, there's a hypocrisy there, isn't there? You know, either we care about people and love them, or we don't, you know. And so I just wish we'd deal with the facts.
And then there's another fact that is absolutely horrific when we look at it in the context of the type of violence happening in South Africa, and that is the violence committed against women, gender-based violence.
Yeah, yeah.
It has, South Africa has the highest rate of gender-based violence among the highest in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
That is not a racial issue.
No.
That is not a case of racial violence. That's a case of violence happening within a group of people who are in power.
Yeah.
Essentially, yeah. We're talking about crimes that are being committed that any society would have to be alarmed at. And so you can say that it's not genocide, but when you look at the sheer number of deaths on the whole happening, the numbers are staggering. Let's forget genocide. Let's forget all of that other, all those other words that
semantics.
Cause us such
semantics.
Yeah, it's just words. It's just words.
Yeah.
When you look at the lives of people who are suffering and who are dying on a daily basis,
yeah,
that is what we're really talking about. That's what's 100%. Driving the narrative underneath the words.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That is why there's no fixing this with rhetoric.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got to do more than talk now.
We've got to return to us being human beings who love other human beings, who respect other beings, human beings equally. But also we've got to get to a place where leaders and politicians actually don't deny. They take it on the chin and say, look, we've screwed up monumentally. We take that. You know, I mean, Khalil, it goes back to, I mean, you are very big on this. I mean, your whole work and life is built around personal responsibility. I screwed up. I need to fix it. I need to be accountable. And I think unless leaders and politicians do that, you know, I mean, in America, there's denial. In South Africa, there's denial. There's just, there's no one that stands up honestly and says, you know what, I screwed up. I'm sorry. I really did monumentally mess up. And not just say that to gain votes or, to be genuinely contrite about the fact that, and just take it on the chin. I screwed up. I'm wrong. But you can only do something about it if you acknowledge them.
If you acknowledge,
you turned your life around. I mean, I've screwed up monumentally. We all have, and unless we take responsibility, we'll never fix it. So how about us just getting our act together as human beings and saying, "Damn, I screwed up. I was wrong. I'm sorry. Help me get it right." You know, I mean, wouldn't the world be a beautiful place?
Yeah, and this is where we have the greatest difficulty. Just in terms of how we even talk about the issues that we're divided on. And just an example, I mean, here in the United States, the level of ideological divisions and just absolutely hateful conversations that are happening is, I think, unprecedented.
I agree.
And one of the reasons it's unprecedented is because we have more ways to hear about it, to know about it, and to witness it in real time. So when I look at how divided America is politically right now, the only way that there is going to be any kind of reconciliation is if people at some point in their personal journey decide to become courageous listeners. And I'm using this concept very intentionally. And because when you have irreconcilable differences, and that what I'm saying is irreconcilable experiences, someone who has been a victim of violence and racism or any of the other ills that we have as a society, and then someone who looks at their life and says, well, this is not as widespread as you're saying it is.
Yeah.
The challenge that we have is that people get locked into their own truth. And that becomes the issue of where it's irreconcilable. But the solution in this is there has to be a commitment. At some point, we have to decide that we're willing to be courageous listeners. And that means I'm prepared to hear something from you that I didn't know, I may not have ever thought about, and just off the cuff, I probably disbelieve.
Right. So, and I could be wrong. I could be wrong.
I could be completely, not only yeah. that, it's called experiential bias. There's an actual term yeah. for yeah. it.
Yeah.
Where our experiences cause us to be biased in such a way that it's almost impossible to see someone else's experience that's different than your own.
Right, right.
We're dealing Very with that. So. We see that every single day. And so that's the challenge, Craig.
Well, and doesn't it boil down to, well, there are two sides of that coin. One is taking personal responsibility for my own screw-ups, and the other one is empathy for me to understand your lived experience, which is different to mine. I mean,
totally.
And this is the whole racial thing, you know, in South Africa and in America too. You know, a person that has never experienced racial discrimination isn't really qualified to talk about it. You know, they can talk about it in theory, but when I meet someone who has experienced that, I need to listen and shut up and say, well, you know what, that's not my lived experience. So that's the one side for me, empathy. From the other side, yeah. there needs to be a sense of, well, you know what, that happened, but I can't let myself be a victim to that. I have to be free of that, because otherwise, you know, it's poisoning me for the rest of my life, and I can become a victim for the rest of my life. So this is the courageous listening, isn't it? I could be wrong. I need to shut up and listen. I need to be humble because I haven't walked in your shoes. And you know what? Let's deal with this, because otherwise you're going to be trapped forever in a sense of victimhood.
Absolutely, it's kind of a perverse sense of entitlement. And I always say that entitlement is the enemy of excellence.
Right.
100%. When you have people who feel entitled, whether it's poverty or victimhood entitlement or trust fund entitlement, mm-hmm. we're talking yeah. about a dynamic that makes it impossible for people to commit to being better human beings.
Right, right.
That's the challenge here. Because
it's the enemy of agency, isn't it? I've got no agency. I'm just a passive victim.
Yeah. And that I have no responsibility in terms of how someone else is experiencing this journey and recognition of the fact that I have some agency here.
Yeah. Yeah.
My agency may not be that I can fix the issue on the spot, but I assure you that if I exercise agency based on my shared humanity with that person who is suffering, that by itself is transformative.
Yeah.
And that's where the commitment has to start.
And, you know, we need to realize that life is not fair.
No.
You talked about poverty and trust fund. I mean, you couldn't get more different, eh? You know, I mean, and the person who was born into poverty and the person who was born to a trust fund, they had nothing to do with it.
Nothing.
they arrived on
it
earth.
It wasn't their choice.
The one woke up, I'm poor. The other one woke up, man, I'm rich. You know, but isn't that the case? You know, you can never take credit for something that you were born into, and you can never be blamed for something you were born into. You know, I mean, but
right.
what we all have to do is take what we've been given, the cards, and play them right. And, yes. and if that's a sense of superiority, you're getting it completely wrong. If that's a sense of blame and guilt or whatever, you know, I mean, you can't inherit these things. You know, you can't inherit guilt, can you? You know, I mean, if your ancestors were guilty, it doesn't mean you are guilty. You know, it means you can be aware of your privilege. You need to be responsible in the use of what you've been blessed by God with. But you know, you can't be guilty for it, and you can't also be blamed for not having. You know, I mean,
well, Craig,
everyone's
going to
play their cards.
Of course, I look at a personal example, just in terms of my own journey, and this whole thing where you said you have to play the cards, the hand that you were dealt, because it wasn't your choice to be born to these circumstances. Right. I had a conversation once with my oldest son. About my incarceration and not being there for him during his childhood and all the way to university. And he looked at me, he said, you know, Pops, I used to think I wish you were here. And I wrote you those letters saying I miss you. He said, but there was a point at which I realized this is the hand I've been dealt. And I've got to figure out how I'm going to play the hand that I've been dealt. And he was specifically talking about some of his cousins who got involved with drugs and selling drugs and some other issues that would have taken him down the path that landed me in prison. And he said, you know, I started thinking about the fact that you've not been here. You haven't been able to help me with these things. He said, and I just knew I had to do something better. I had to do something different than them if I didn't want to end up where you are, where you were.
Fantastic.
And I think that it comes down to that.
It does. I mean, that's just amazing story. I mean, he didn't get dealt a great hand, but
no,
he played it so well, man. He played it so well, and I mean, that's that's a
and I didn't help.
If we could all do
that. I didn't help him. And the thing that I'm saying, Craig, is there has to be some accountability on my part. I have to recognize that there was harm I created.
Right.
That there was a damage that I'm responsible for. And not just acknowledge it in some abstract sense. I've got to take that information and try to be a better human being with it. Not be a victim of it, but be a better, use it to be a better human being. Use it to talk to other men who I've spoken with in the past who tell me the reason they were in prison because they didn't have a solid male role model. There was no father figure and all those things. Now, here's the kicker. Many of those men I talk with who have that narrative are 40, 50 years old. And here's the implication of that. While they grew up without a father, I grew up with a father. I grew up with a mother present. I grew up with all of those things that none of them had. I had the privilege. I had the bubble. I had all the wonderful things that should translate to being a really decent human being. But let me just say, until I took responsibility for what that meant in my life, it didn't mean anything. It was pointless. And so when I talk to those men, I say to them, yes, you've grown up without a father, but now you have six children and you've not been a father to any of them. How do we square that? So for me, being absent in my son's life, his childhood, because of my choices that led me to prison, my acknowledgement meant that I had to do something beyond my individual son. That is to say, my son was grown. He picked me up from prison. Mm-hmm. When I paroled out of prison at 40 years old, my son, my oldest son, was now an adult man and picked me up.
Beautiful.
So now I've got to be a better human being to him at a whole different level. I've got to now interact with him in a way that honors the journey he's made, the integrity that he's demonstrated, the courage that he had to make better decisions and to acknowledge that his father had made many poor decisions and loved me still.
Fantastic.
Loved me still. So this, my son by almost any definition was a victim to my own behavior, to my horrible choices. He didn't deserve that. I caused that pain. And until I recognize my role in the causing of that pain and the fact that I can do something about it, maybe not change the situation. In fact, not change the situation with him and going back. But there's a lot of young men like the work that you're doing, Craig, like the work that you do all over South Africa. Those are not your biological sons, but you've taken them on. You've done what some men did with my son.
Right.
They looked at my son in the eyes and said to him, we're not going to allow your father's failure to be an excuse for you.
Yeah.
That's the work that you're doing. And that is why, at a very deep spiritual level, there's a resonance with me, because I recognize you're one of the men who stepped in the gap when I failed.
Wow.
That's the story that we're talking about. That's the agency that we mean. And there's no, that's you can't fake that. No, that's something that you have to do. And people will know you by what you do in that regard.
Yeah. But you know, Khalil, there's so many beautiful truths that come out of that story, man. I mean, the one is second chances. The one is that, man, I mean, you know, through your mistakes and through your journey through the fire and the pain, you are now helping way more men than you ever would have done had you not made those mistakes. And I mean, that's a beautiful thing that God often does. Hey? I mean, takes what was intended for bad and harm and turns it for good. So, I mean, you and again, that's the deep resonance we've always had as brothers, man. I mean, we have the heart of a father. You know, I was a single dad. We both had our experiences. And I mean, the heart of the father means, man, we don't just father our own kids, man. We father way more. And in some strange way, there's purpose in the pain that we went through. There's purpose in the fire that we experience, you know, that because you have the courage and the balls to say, I screwed up and I regret it. And you now have the power and the authority and the wisdom to break the cycle, not just for you and your son, but for many, many other men and sons. I mean, that's the one truth. The second chance is the power. I mean, your authority now as a father figure, as an elder in your community, as a person who's working in university colleges around America and helping so many previously incarcerated men, I mean, your authority and your wisdom in that is way in excess of, for instance, what I have. I hadn't had that experience, or what you would have had you not. So, I mean, it's phenomenal, the power of a mistake that's healed and repented of. You know, I mean, it's awesome, isn't it? And you're experiencing
that's the
that.
Work. Yes, brother. Yeah. That's the work. And that's why I say, I look at your journey. Just when you were telling me about the story of when your son took up kickboxing and he got in the ring and he's in the ring, he's a kid. He's a young man.
Yeah. 17 when he had that fight.
17. And he's fighting a man.
27-year-old.
Across the other side. And this is a man who wants to do harm to him, who wants to hurt him. And there's no like mystery about it. There's nothing hidden about it. It's sheer straight on. I'm going to hurt you today.
Yeah.
Now, as a father sitting there in your son's corner, and being a man of the age of the man he's fighting, just the idea looking at it, it feels completely unfair. Completely unfair. Your son happened to have won that fight.
Yeah.
Of course, the joy as a father. But it still didn't change the fact that for you as a father, it felt terribly unfair, unequal.
Very much so. Yeah.
Unequal.
Yeah.
But that's how life is.
Yeah.
That's just how life is.
It is. And until there's no doubt about it. It's not fair.
Yeah. We have to man up. We have to. Listen, when we talk about this issue of how divided people are around their ideologies and how the narrative is being driven by people who really have no sense of what motivates someone at the level of leaving their country and everything they've ever known to go to a new place to start over. The reason why it's so hard for some people to grasp that narrative is because they've never been in that situation.
They've never been,
They've never been in a situation like that. So for them, it's much more difficult to grasp the granular aspects of how someone could be pushed to that point. Mm-hmm. And I say that using a completely different narrative to say courageous listening means that even though I don't have that exact experience, I need to look at my life and realize there's things about my experiences that no one else can see. Yeah. And it would be very difficult for them to have empathy for me if there's no acknowledgement that we can have very different experiences.
Correct.
And still both be good human beings.
Absolutely.
I mean, because, you know, and I'm mentioning that, Craig, because so many people demonize folks who don't think and speak and agree with their views. They're just absolutely demonized.
They're demonized. You know, I mean, firstly, going on from your story, you know, of your son, I mean, the second beautiful thing that's come out of that is you mentioned men that stepped up and filled the gap that spoke to your son. I mean, and Khalil, I mean, this is something you and I are both passionate about, you know. Masculinity is a beautiful gift to the world. Young bulls need older bulls, man. And
yes.
And as a brotherhood, we can heal the world. We can heal the world. Yeah. I mean, those men that step in, beautiful men, you know. I get so pissed off when, you know, we talk about toxic masculinity and we talk about men are trash, because the heart of a man, the heart of a father, the heart that you have now, that I have, is a beautiful thing. It's a protective thing. It's a powerful thing.
Yes.
You know, when men get together and call each other out and sharpen each other, when they get together and they mentor the next year, it's a beautiful thing, man. And, you know, I mean, going back to that understanding and empathy, there are aspects of masculinity that women will not understand. Yeah. There are aspects of femininity that we would battle to understand, you know.
Of course.
And the difference between men and women is beautiful. Because that dance, you know, but going back to men, those men who stepped up, man, I want to hug those brothers, you know. I mean, those are good men, not perfect men, you know. I mean, none of us are, but men who said, you know, I'm going to step up. He has a young man who needs. I'm, you know, the brotherhood, Khalil, is a beautiful thing.
It's amazing.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's amazing because at the same time, there were men in my son's community who stepped in. At my worst in prison, there were men also convicted of crimes who had already done the work that I was trying to do of transformation.
Yeah.
And they stepped in with me.
Fantastic.
And
Fantastic.
Tried to give a word of encouragement. Imagine at the very bottom of life, caught up in all of the madness of prison, even there, in that really, really dark space, there were men who stepped into the light and who became the light.
Wow.
And mentored me.
Beautiful.
And took Beautiful. The time to be a father figure in a prison, an That's uncle, amazing. A brother. Took the.
Yeah.
They had the heart.
Yeah.
They had the heart to do that.
It's so beautiful.
And that's the part, Craig. So there's all kinds of contradictions, inconsistencies, things that seem completely contradictory happening all at the same time.
And, you know, it goes back to that labels we give each other. You know, I mean, identity politics and labeling is got to be the most dehumanizing practice in the world. You know, you label someone a convict. I'll give you an example. I talked at a prison here in Johannesburg. I think I've shared the story with me. And there were 20 men, and I was asked to come in, given special permission to go into the prison to talk to these men. And Khalil, it was one of the most heartbreaking experiences of my life, because after I did my talk to these men, motivational talk, you know, I saw in these men I tell you what, I saw beauty in these men. I mean, and you go into a prison and the label is these are convicts, these are criminals, these are animals. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And at the end of the talk, I said to the convener, I said, I just want to go and hug these men. And I went, the first man I hugged, he wouldn't let go. He clung on to, he would not. And I was hugging this man and I just, it was all I could do to stop weeping, you know, and he was just crying out for love. And I saw in these men a goodness, you know, they had taken a wrong turn. Life had been tough. They'd made a mistake, but they were not bad men. And I went around one by one and I hugged all 20. And I mean, the brotherhood and the love that flowed, they were hungry. Khalil, I went back to the parking lot. I sat in my car and I sobbed, man. I just sobbed because I just felt such compassion for these men. And I also sobbed because of a system that it's a disgusting system. You know, I mean, you lock up someone, you know, instead of rehabilitating, instead of restoring their dignity, instead of, you know, helping them, you know, and I mean, you've talked about this, that, you know, that prison is a jungle, man. That prison.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. Sometimes people go in there for 3 years and they end up staying 10 years because they have to commit atrocities just to stay alive in the system. Anyway, I wept, man. And I mean, this is the whole thing. We label people. You're a convict. You're a black man. You're a white man. You're a Democrat. You're a Republican. You're a Trump supporter. I mean, who cares? You're a human being, man. You know.
Yeah.
You know, and we label and then we judge based on that. You know, and we've got to get beyond that. Eh? We've really got to get beyond that.
I mean, I guess for me, in many ways, that's really the greatest tragedy of humanity, is that we fail to see our shared humanity. It's
you've hit the nail on the head.
That we do not see, as human as we are, as fragile as we know we are as human beings, to look at another human being and not recognize that they too are fragile, they too are trying to figure it out. To lose sight of that and to label and to blame, it just doesn't move the needle. I get it, but it doesn't move the needle for good.
No.
And so I've just decided, and this also kind of goes into the prison narrative, I've just decided that no matter what circumstances I find myself in, I am going to do everything in my power to take ownership for how I got there, how those circumstances came to be, and then look at my life, my own agency, and see what good I can do in it.
Beautiful.
Not even necessarily change it, brother. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, because changing things external is far more difficult than many of us recognize.
Yeah.
We think you can change things and that's it.
We don't see it in ourselves, do we?
That's right. So if I can see it in me, if I can first identify in myself what's necessary to change, and I can actually do it, I can bring it to some level of consciousness and behavior, then generally what I have found, to the extent that I'm able to change, everything else changes.
Absolutely.
And everything,
you know, going back to Trump and Ramaphosa and politics, wouldn't it be beautiful if governments could do that? If politicians could do that? I mean, just be honest, man. Just be real. Just be authentic. So, I mean, we screwed up. And if the media, it's so sad what's happened to media, isn't it? Because media, I mean, journalism used to be, I'm going to find the truth wherever it may be found. You know, if it agrees with me, if it disagrees with me, if you know, but we've lost that. Hey, I mean, it's now I'm going to interpret whatever happens in the light of my biased ideological lens, and I'm going to report it, towing the party line, even if it's bullshit.
It's where we end up.
It's where we end up. I guess that's why, you know, I mean, people are turning to podcasts because they're just more honest. They don't have some big investor, you know, with a narrative that says, you know, you've got to interpret everything through this lens.
No, and it doesn't matter. Listen, the bottom line is we don't have to toe the line politically with any of the script that's out there because we have enough lived experience in our own journeys to look at something and say, you know what? Yeah, I did this and it was just pure nonsense. Yeah, I said that, and it was just ridiculous. I absolutely do not think that way today. I absolutely would not behave that way today. Right. But I do acknowledge that it is how I have thought, and it is how I have behaved, and I take ownership for that. And what ownership means for me is that I no longer behave in that way. I no longer think that way. I'm now conscious enough to correct my own thinking and to correct my own actions.
Yeah,
that's the challenge. And all of us have that level of agency to some extent. The only question is, are we using it to the maximum extent that we can for our good and the good of others?
Well, it takes courage, doesn't it, to admit that I was wrong. And to admit, hey, you know, I don't like you, but you're right. I mean, that's hard. Eh? I disagree with you, but actually you're right. I mean, but that's real humanity, isn't it? You know, if I can see the error in my own tribe, you know, whatever my tribe is, and I can see the truth in another tribe, whether it's a political group, whatever it is, that's true. That's a great man or a great woman. Eh?
Because,
you know, even if it hurts me, I'm going to admit it, you know, but Khalil, how many people are that honest? How many people are that courageous?
Yeah, but this is where we get into our labels. This is where, for example, it's very easy for someone on the left to say that someone, for example, like Vice President Vance, it's very easy for someone on the left to say, well, he's racist. The policies that he's promoting and supporting and advocating for, he's got to be racist. Now, for me, that's just such a ridiculous place to start from if you intend to make any kind of progress. Why does someone who has a view different than you need to be demonized? That's a problem.
That is a problem. And that's someone what we do.
Absolutely. Someone can have a different view than us. For example, the issue of immigration in the United States right now is such a hot topical issue that and people fall on all sides of the fence, but typically left or right. And so the argument that many are making is that these people are being deported without due process. And they're pointing to the numbers of this happening and the fact that the administration, to their mind, is doing this illegally or unconstitutionally. And so one of the people in my social media was contacting me, reached out to me about this and was really complaining and everything. And I simply asked them, I said, do you have any idea how many people are in prison in America? And the person that obviously they're saying, yeah, there's a lot of people in prison, blah, but what has that got to do with it? I said, well, by the most conservative statistics, 2 to 5% of that very large population are completely innocent. They're just innocent. And there are statistics that tell us why that population, we know that the percentages are there at the most conservative level.
So wrongly
convicted. I just asked, when was the last time? Yeah. So when was the last time you were out protesting in the streets about the fact that someone is sitting in an American prison who statistically and in terms of their charges, we can see that there's not much adequate due process that's been applied here because if it were, they wouldn't be there. Yes. So, but there's no outrage about that. There's no protests in the streets. We're not getting news articles written about it or any of those things. And here's what I say. It's a kind of duplicity that we're seeing. We're seeing people who it's fashionable in some respects, if you're on the left, to attack these kinds of policies without any consequences, without any responsibility for the violence that's happening in many communities coming from the population we're talking about.
But it's virtue signaling, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm saying it doesn't register because you know what, Craig? We're living here in America, we have a sad reality that's hidden in plain sight. And that is, if you're a person of color, in my case, if you have a son that's stopped and by the police and murdered, there's almost a kind of perverse celebrity that happens here in America. For the parent of a child or a son or a relative who gets murdered by the police particularly I'm talking about a white police officer who gets charged with killing a person of color, and specifically a black person. Now, we get we all know what happened as a response to George Floyd. Yeah. Right. We are still grappling with the fallout from that. And there's been a backlash in some respects. There's been pushback from that time to now. And here's what I'm going to say in terms of the gaps and the silences. Mm-hmm. I was one of the people out at the first year anniversary of George Floyd's murder. I shot a documentary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We did work on the ground in front of United Foods, the place where he was murdered. And I saw the emotions and the actual rage that was there. Shortly thereafter, my own son, my own youngest son, was murdered, shot by a young man in a hoodie. And I remember distinctly, I was still filming the 1 year memorial of George Floyd's murder when my son was murdered, 13 days after his 38th birthday.
Sure.
And I can tell you, there was no Ben Crump. There were no civil rights attorneys who came to me. Mm-hmm. And I was filming at the time when all of those civil rights attorneys were there talking about George Floyd's case. There was no invitation to speak before Congress like Felonese, George Floyd's brother, did. There was barely even an acknowledgement that anything even had happened. And because I'm going to tell you the reason black. Why. It's because he was killed. He was murdered by a boy who looked just like him, who could have been him.
Yeah.
And so, and you know how I found out? Two police officers came to my door, knocked on my door. I'm like, what's going on here? And they asked me, are you Khalil Osiris? I said, yeah. Do you have a son? Siddhartha? Yeah, what's going on? I'm thinking maybe Sid got in some trouble. Sure. My worst fears of him going to jail, all those kinds of things rushing through my mind. And they said, well, we need you to call this number. I called the number and it was a detective who said he'd been trying to reach me. And he sent my son had my information in his belongings. And they reached me a day later. And he tells me my son has been murdered.
Sure.
I'm just telling you that this is I thought that he was mistaken, really, honestly.
Yeah.
This is not my son. This is someone else. Bottom line is, it was my son. The two police officers who were very kind ask if I'd like them to stay for a while to help me get through. Are there any calls they could make on my behalf? Is there anything that they could do that would be helpful? And in fact, one of the police officers happened to live in the state where my son was murdered. They were so helpful that it was almost like I had, like you were there or something. Someone who I would have really, someone who I knew. And I knew really had a heart for what I had just been told. These were two white police officers. Mm. Two young white police officers. Now, all I'm saying to you is this. There was no ideology in that moment.
Right.
There was no left and there was no right. There was only my son who had been murdered in my mind. And the end result was, it barely made the news. Hmm. It barely made the news at the very time that I was doing a documentary on George Floyd's murder. Yeah. And I'm talking to the civil rights attorneys who are representing the case. I've got pictures from that period of me with Breonna's boyfriend who was in the house with George Floyd's brothers and cousins. I'm telling you all this to say the rhetoric did not move the needle at all. In fact, it obscured a deeper truth.
Yeah.
It obscured it, something hidden in plain sight, that we somehow have gotten to a place where even the murder of our children takes on a political connotation.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It's just, I come to this with a very different lens than a lot of people who are unwilling to acknowledge the deep contradiction of the crime of people within communities happening at a scale that just is shocking. If you really put a microscope on it, it's shocking. And that will not change until the people in our communities decide that it's not the police we need. It's a recognition of our shared humanity and the values that reflect that that's most needed. 100%. That's what it is.
That'll fix the world. It'll fix the world, Kyle. Because, I mean, for instance, race is literally skin deep. Skin deep, isn't it?
Of course it is, brother.
It's a physical trait.
You wouldn't even know. We wouldn't even know we were different colors. We wouldn't even have a clue about that. If our lives were lived in such a way where we really valued our shared humanity, don't you know that would eclipse every single thing else that's out there? It would eclipse it.
100%.
Because it's so massive. It is so important to our existence. The other stuff is things we've created. We just fabricated this stuff.
It's superficial. It's completely don't you love, did you listen to that interview with Morgan Freeman? I forget who was interviewing him, but the guy was saying to him, you know, a white guy, he said, what can we do to stop racism? And Morgan, he said, I'll tell you what, you stop calling me a black man, I'll stop calling you a white man, and then it's over. It's just, I mean, let's stop labeling each other. You know, you're a man.
Yeah.
I'm a man. Cut the bullshit. I mean, it was, you know, coming from him, because I admire him deeply, he's a wonderful guy.
Of course.
I mean, that really is profound in its truth, isn't it?
It's just such a simple, like we make it so complicated.
It's, so
it, we make it's it just so like when, as children, when we look at our parents, I've never heard a child say, who looks lovingly at their parent, that somehow their parent didn't get it right or all. That's not even in the equation. It's just not there.
Yeah,
it's not relevant to anything. So no matter, we have an opportunity, brother, to actually be what we say.
Yeah.
To literally, we have the capacity as human beings, every other animal in creation, their nature's fixed.
Yeah.
A dog is never going to do anything but act like a dog. And you can train it to do tricks, but guess what? It's still a dog.
Yeah,
and it's doing it for the food. But as human beings, we don't have any ceiling on our humanity, our nature.
Yeah.
It's vast. But if we don't cultivate it,
exactly.
If we don't do anything with it, then we're not going to get much out of it.
No.
That's just the way that it works. And that's not black or white, rich or poor. That's whoever you are as a human being. If you don't do much with your humanity, you're not going to get much out of it.
It's got nothing to do with male or female, American or South African, nationality, ethnicity, language.
No.
All of those are superficial items of identification. And within every human being, man, woman, child, is the capacity for great good and great evil. And, yes. And you know, the greatest gift we've been given by God is the gift of agency. You get to choose.
Yes.
What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? You know, going back to that, you know, you mentioned the issue of life experience, and I think it's so powerful. You know, I love the quote that says, you know, when we were young growing up, someone else held the pen that was writing our story. I mean, we didn't choose where we were born, what neighborhood our parents, but we get to an age where the pen is in our hands, you know, and we've got to choose what story am I going to write? So, yes. You know, lived experience, if you base your worldview on your lived experience, you're missing the plot. You know, I'll give an example. I had a friend who went to Australia for a holiday, and he booked a place in Sydney online, which is often a mistake. And it happened to be a place downtown Sydney, which is a pretty dodgy area. And, you know, he went to Australia with a perception that it's a safe country. You know, very first night, he goes for a stroll down the street, and he gets mugged. And he was so traumatized that he left 2 days later. And he came back to South Africa with a real view that Australia is a dangerous place, you know. But the reality is Australia is a very safe place, you know. He yes. happened to have an experience which was a bad experience. And you don't want to undermine that experience. But he judged the whole of Australia based on one, you know. You know, we have a bad experience, you know, we might have a bad experience with a woman and we label all women, you know, I mean, it's a stupid thing to do, you know. You've got to look at the facts.
I'll tell you, one of the things that most impacted me about your story is when you told me about how your first wife was brutalized. And the fact of like how you dealt with that and having an experience like that, you could have been one of those people who looked at that experience and did just what your friend did.
Yeah.
Blamed everyone. Said, there's like, this is just crazy as it was, as it is. Mm. And yet been a wounded, walk around wounded from it. Mm. You didn't. Mm. You didn't. You did something stronger. You did something. And for me, my example is one of Christ, the model in him for our humanity. And that is to say, when faced with the most devastating experience that we can imagine, when it has happened to us, our response in that moment, in that situation, can go a lot of different ways. But the model that I have been so inspired by in Christ, and what I have tried in my own journey in some kind of ways to follow, is to take in that moment and choose my higher angels. Absolutely. And choose a greater good. Choose it.
Yeah.
You did that. You told me about that story long before my son was murdered. Mm. And let me just tell you, brother, as I sat with myself reflecting on what I need to do next, they had a young man arrested who was going on trial. They invited me to go to testify and to, in some ways, ensure that he got a very long prison sentence. I chose not to go.
Wow.
I can tell you, as your brother, I never, ever, ever had one moment of hatred to that young man who murdered my son. Never one moment of hatred towards him. And part of that came out of my own experience of having been a kid who committed a robbery and went to prison. And I grasped the weight of that and how absolutely destructive I became continuing that path. And so I thought about this young man and what who had murdered my son and what would be my response. Rather than going to that trial to testify against him, I went out to a juvenile rehabilitation center and made an appointment to go in and talk with some young men who were exactly like the young man who murdered my son. And my message to them is the only person that you are destined to become is the person you decide to be.
Wow. Powerful message. Powerful.
Be a good person today. Recognize that your power isn't dependent on defending a reputation that means nothing.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, brother, that I sat with the words that you said about your own horrific experience and the choice that you made for good, the agency that you used for good in the most horrific situation. Mm. That's what helped to inform my decision about how I would respond.
It's amazing.
With the young man who murdered my son.
It's powerful, Khalil. I mean, I tell you, and you know, if through our stories we can help and inspire young men to make the right choices and use that incredible gift of agency, because I think that's the greatest gift we have, the gift to choose what kind of man we want to be. Do we walk around for the rest of our lives angry and as a victim and blaming others? Or do we say, you know what? Cannot change what happened, but I can change what I'm going to become. You know?
Yes.
And powerful, yes. Man. And, you know, Khalil, I mean, this is probably a good note to end our conversation, but I'm looking so forward to so many more conversations around our stories and our learnings and how we can truly, truly, I mean, you know, in chatting about what do we call this, you know, we both came up with this thing, speaking the truth, inspiring change. And
yes.
And I love that, you know, I love That's you, exactly brother. I appreciate brother, you, man.
And this truth that we're talking about is truth that starts with correcting ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Being humble, looking in the mirror and seeing
correction. Yes. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes.
Awesome. Awesome, man. Awesome. Yeah. Any other closing thoughts?
No, I just want to say, brother, I really appreciate the fact that we're able to have these kinds of conversations as two men who really care about the kind of human beings we show up as.
Yeah.
And to be able to talk through these kinds of issues and challenges, I think that there's a lot of men who are locked in labels and titles and ideas about who they should be that just doesn't fit with their reality.
Absolutely.
And the only thing that's going to really transform that situation is truth telling. The capacity to speak truth.
Yeah.
Without fear of being canceled, without fear of someone disliking you or any of that. We've got to get to that place. And I think that our conversations provide a platform for that to happen.
Without a doubt.
And that's my prayer.
And maybe, you know, a good place to kick off our next conversation is the issue of identity. Who am I really?
Yes.
I mean, all these identities that we hide behind in many ways are in a way our surname. You know, they're generic. You know, my ethnicity is generic. My nationality is generic, my gender. But within those group identities, I have a unique identity. You know, you are Khalil. There's no one like you, me. And maybe, you know, that'd be a good thing to explore next time.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you a difficult question? Have you forgiven yourself? You
Craig,
talked about your son, you know.
That's the question that transformed my life. My forgiveness of me is rooted in a recognition that everything that I'm calling me has been my creation. Like I literally created it without knowing it. And
right.
Consequently, I have been able to not just forgive what I created, but transform it.
Beautiful.
And it's that accountability that says everything that I have done, everything I have said, everything I have believed is connected to a level of agency that to this point I was completely clueless about. Mm. I compulsively created this. Imagine right. what I could do if I become conscious. And that's been my struggle. That's like Beautiful. When I, the question you're asking, Craig, I don't think anyone could have asked me that question more pointedly than you, because we know the struggles that each other have had. And we know the dedication to being a better human being that each of us walk with every day. Mm-hmm. So that level of mutual recognition, shared humanity, and absolute unwavering commitment to accountability on our part is what gives that question its gravitas.
Fantastic.
It's us and our dedication to being better human beings that cannot happen absent forgiveness.
Yeah.
And it can't happen absent forgiving yourself, because the creator of the thing that you're complaining, that of that thing, is ourselves.
Yeah.
It's hidden in plain sight. The fact that we are accountable is hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Thank you for that question, brother, because it is the forgiveness that I have been able to continuously, not one time, to continuously confront and recommit to in the face of every single challenge. Because it's not something you do once.
No, it's something you live in.
You live in that.
You know what just occurred to me now, and I mean, we're going quite deep now, but you know, when I look at you, I see a beautiful man. And my heart's desire is that you see the same in you.
Absolutely, brother.
Is that you see a beautiful man too. You
know? Yes.
Because unless you do, unless we see ourselves as God sees us, beautiful human beings,
yes.
flawed, but forgiven and growing.
Yes.
You know, we're not going to bring beauty to the world. We're going to be dutiful. We're going to be angry. But, you know, I've just realized my desire for you as a brother is for you to see yourself as I see you, which is a beautiful man.
And,
you know,
and I mean, brother,
that's God bring to each other.
Brother, that is what God does. That is why we are called. That is why we give meaning to this journey in a way that recognizes the operative word for all our differences is called grace.
Yep. Yep.
The operative word and the operative concept, the action that has to come out of it is called grace. Yep. It's been given freely, abundantly, eternally. It's been given. Why would we choose to be such wretched creatures that we can't extend what we've been given in abundance?
Absolutely.
We have no lack of it.
Yep.
So I just refuse to be an ungrateful human being about the grace that I've been given so abundantly. Yep. My brother, my sister deserves more than I can give them. That's why we've got someone bigger to me to ensure that they get it. But I definitely need to do my part, brother.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that's the pure joy in living, hey? Giving. Yes. Giving back. Hey, brother, this is wonderful stuff, man. It's the start of a journey, huh?
Yes.
Start of a journey.
Definitely.